Hello and welcome to Inside Education with me, Sean Delaney. Inside Education is your weekly podcast for educators who are interested in teaching. I'm a teacher educator and primary teacher myself, and I've written a book about teaching called Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have. You can access an archive of almost 400 past episodes of Inside Education by going to my website, seandelaney.com, and clicking on podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at InsideEd. To email me, the address is insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. My guest on the programme this week is Finbar Hurley, a coordinator of the Centre for School Leadership and a board member of the Irish Primary Principals Network. Finbar Hurley has had an interesting career in education to date that has brought him from Mary Immaculate College to Principal of St Columba's Boys' School in Douglas Cork, from which he is seconded to the Centre for School Leadership. He has extensive experience of the European school system, having been a teacher, a pedagogical coordinator and a primary principal in schools in Mall, in Brussels and Karlsruhe. He also spent time as administrative deputy principal of a large international school in Qatar. You'd like this podcast if you've ever wondered what it would be like to work in a European school and the kinds of opportunities that lie there for Irish teachers. Or if you want to find out more about the variety of work that is available to someone in the course of a teaching career. You'll also find some ideas about leadership in education. When I met up with Finbar Hurley on the fringes of the 2020 Irish Primary Principals Network annual conference last month, I first asked him why he became a teacher.
It's all I've ever wanted to do. From the age of four, I just wanted to be a teacher. Yeah, I suppose I grew up in a really small community where school was the centre of everything, and it was a four-teacher school with great teachers, and I just felt, yeah, this is what I want to do. And I suppose I went into Mary I in 1991 and did my leaving cert, first in my family to go to university, etc., and was offered UCC as well. And my mother didn't talk to me for 2 weeks. She said, why are you going teaching? You can do this, you can do that. You're going teaching, you're going into the education sphere when there's absolutely no jobs, there's nothing. What are you going to do in 3 years' time? She didn't talk to me for 2 weeks, but all I wanted to do was be a teacher.
And what was it about the four-year-old Finbar that kind of said, I want to teach? Like, what did you see around you in school?
I suppose I like kids. You know, I just liked the whole thing of the blackboard and explaining to people and being up in front of people. As I got older, I'm the eldest of all my cousins, so I was the babysitter. So I'd always be looking for ways to keep them entertained and doing things with them. And it just felt natural for me to go down that route. I never considered anything else. It was just teaching. That's all I wanted to do.
And how was your experience in Mary Immaculate College?
I loved it. I suppose it was a time when Mary Immaculate College was really small. There were only 300 in the whole college. So you had 101st year, 102nd year and 103rd year. That was it. Of that, there was 10 lads in our year and 90 girls. And it was like, oh, what's this? This is all very new. I was a very shy young fella coming up from West Cork to Limerick. And I really grew into myself in Mary. I loved my 3 years. I got involved in everything. And just, I suppose from day one, it was a case of, yeah, this was good. And I'll never forget my first micro teaching, which was like 2 weeks in, and was with one of the professors, and I was just doing my thing with the kids, and he came up to me after and said, you're a natural, like you were doing things that people sort of, it takes them a while to get, but you just had it. So I said, okay, that was good affirmation at the beginning of it, you know.
And if you look back now over the 3 years of the course, how well did it prepare you for the work of teaching?
I didn't really, you know, you're green. I'll never forget, I finished in June. By the end of June, I had my first position for the following year all sorted. I was very lucky. And I had a year position in Glenmire. And I'll never forget, I was all summer long saying, oh, what am I going to do? You know, and you go in the first day and you're completely and utterly green. It prepares you in some ways, but in other ways, for the real hard, cold face of it, it doesn't, you know? And that's why your co-teachers, your colleagues, your mentors were really, really important in those first few years of teaching. I think it has changed a lot, but at that time, it was a case of, you know, this is what you do, this is how you teach this, this is how you teach that. But I think the whole thing of actually dealing with the needs of kids and the parental expectations, the parental needs, we didn't really look at that. And when you start in your career and you start in any school, you have to prove yourself to your kids, parents and your colleagues. And I suppose I like changing jobs. I change every 5 or 6 years. And this was always one of my motivating factors, because, you know, you reach a plateau, you know, you're in a school a certain amount of time, you get a reputation, you know, and if you have a good reputation, can't coast in it. And like, you know, it's the case of, right, we need to change this up. We need to go down another road again and prove yourself again all over. So that would be a motivation for all my changes.
You know? And when you say that the course didn't really prepare you for teaching, could the course have been different and could it have prepared you better? Or is it something that really you had to learn in the classroom?
You have to learn it in the classroom. Also age, I suppose. I was 17 when I was going into Mary Eye, and my life experience would have been quite limited. You know, you come straight out of school, secondary school, where it's Leaving Cert, you're going into this, and Ireland in 1994 was very different to Ireland what it is now. It's a job that you actually have to learn as you're doing it, as you're going along. You know, there's no doubt about it. Like, yes, the philosophy and the theory behind the whys is really, really important. You had that, you know, you had that in your toolkit. So you understand why you were doing things. But the actual nitty-gritties of the classroom organization, setting up, until you have your own classroom in front of you, you can't really plan that in advance. So, yeah, that was the biggest challenge in the first year. First year or two, just finding out my style, finding out what suits the kids in front of me, what's the best way that they learn, and figuring out how do I implement this with 36 kids in my first class. How do I meet the needs of every single one of these kids? You know, so that was...
How did you answer that question? How did you meet their needs?
Oh, it was trial and error basis. Literally, it was trial and error. And it was spending time with them, literally figure out what did they like. So I'd go to playtime and say, you know, just listen to what they're talking about and sort of find out ways in the class, like the visual learners, they need to hear it, they need to write it down, you know, figuring out what made them tick. And once you got a handle on that, that takes time. So it took the first maybe 4 months to figure that out. And then the second half of the year, I knew where I was going with them. So it was good.
And you stayed in that school in Glenmire for a few years, did you? Yeah.
So it was a temporary position. So I was there for 1 year. I was in a girls' school, all that, an all-girls school after that for a year, at sixth class there. It was very interesting. When I moved to Douglas a few years ago, one of the mothers came up and said, you know, of a boy in sixth class, said, you were my teacher. And I was like, oh, Jesus, now I'm old. But like, there's only an 8-year age gap between us, you know, which is, when you think about it, it's crazy. Then I went to Gaelscoil in Bandon for 3 years, came back to Cork City for 4 years, to Upper Glenmire, another part of Glenmire, loved it, and then decided I need to go further afield, and had seen the European school advertised maybe 2 years before it. It was Varese in Italy. I said, I'd love to just live there. But anyway, Brussels came up. I said, give it a go. So headed off to Brussels, my two suitcases, and it was the place where I learned about myself, learned so much about independence, looking after yourself, and, you know, how to actually meet new people, you know, learn a language, sort of set up home in a new country, and spent 5 years in the European School of Mull, which is just outside of Brussels, and had fantastic opportunities there. So I went in as head of the English section, and we were a small section. I was teaching 3 classes at the time there, and my principal was Irish, and he said, Finbar, if you had to design a classroom for the future, what would it look like? I said, I love this. So he got 30,000 euros. He said, okay, there you go, but we'll give it to you on the caveat that we will bring people in from all over Europe to see this classroom in action. So I was given, the very first smart board in the whole of Europe, and had the smart training, everything, and laptops for the kids, and I had a control panel on my desk where I could change between video at the time, and it was fantastic, and high tables and high chairs for kids' posture. We thought everything out, but literally every week, there was one day I had 80 people waiting in a queue to come inside to my room. Like, there was inspectors from all over. Every European inspector with at least 2 heads of delegation, and then other teachers as well. And I was like, right, you can come in 5 at a time, but it's going to take you the day to get in. So from an early stage, I knew that, like, yes, this is a unique opportunity.
And for people who don't know what the European schools are, can you just give an overview?
Okay, so a quick synopsis. European schools are for the children of diplomats who are maybe seconded out to a European institution. The aim behind it is that when the kids come back to their home country, they will integrate straight away into the curriculum that they left before. For example, we were teaching Gaelga out there as well. There are 14 of them around Europe. Every European school has different language sections. So they all have English, French, German, you can have Portuguese, Spanish, Greek, Finnish, Danish. So you have all of the education systems from the national countries working alongside each other on a common curriculum, right? So they're bringing their own methodologies from their own countries. and teaching it a common European school curriculum. And then every day for 45 minutes, kids get a second language. They move around to second language teachers. So I would have been the English second language teacher, where I would be getting kids from all the other nationalities coming in, and I would be teaching them English. And in 5 years, their level of English was just crazy. So that's literally essentially it. And I suppose as time was going on in the European schools, they wanted more and more harmonization. So in Brussels, they opened a new school, Brussels 4. We started with 75 kids. When I left 5 years later, we had 1,700 kids. But my job there was a primary coordinator to bring all of the curricula together. So I was leading curriculum, and like, everyone has very different attitudes. The French teacher could be standing at the back of the room looking at the backs of the kids' heads, and that's how they teach, you know? The Swedish have sofas like this. They have four or five sofas in their room, and their kids are just sitting around chatting on sofas, and that's how they teach. So it was just seeing all of the different ways of how people teach, saying, oh, that's a brilliant idea. No, I'd never do that. Your toolkit was being added to the whole time, you know?
And is there much collaboration there among the teachers? I mean, like sometimes schools can be quite closed, where teachers rarely get to see other teachers teaching. Was it like that in the European schools?
No, there was huge collaboration. We had to, because obviously when you're delivering a common curriculum across a school, there has to be huge commonality, and you know, your value system is the same, so you're feeding into the same ideals. So we collaborated hugely. Yes, we would have different approaches, but we would still have common plans, and we would have lots of discussions then about what's the best way maybe to do this. Can we maybe look at changing our own national ways a small bit to try a different way, and to see, does that work for you? Does it work for us in general? You know, is there something that might work across 7 sections that you're saying, this really, really works, this is worth, you know, sort of putting out to the other European schools? And there would be a lot of collaboration with the other schools as well. So it's quite a complex situation, quite a complex school system, but it was fantastic. My teaching style in the 10 years that I was teaching there changed hugely. And I suppose I was teaching full-time for the first 6 years. When I went to this Brussels 4, the second school, I did much reduced teaching load. So it was a real middle management position, you know. So I had a reduced teaching load, but as primary coordinator of pedagogy. And it was my job to pull pedagogy together. After that, then, I was to come back, but the department gave anyone who was coming back from the European schools a year's grace to figure out what they want to do before they come back into their school situation, which was fantastic. So I had the opportunity to go to the Middle East as a deputy principal. So I was deputy principal of a school in Qatar. And I was brought in. There were 2 deputy principals. It was fantastic. And with principal, primary, 2 deputies. You know, there's a big issue over there with morale, with the way the kids are. Your job now is to fix that, you know? So we went through to school, but we had coaches in school. It was amazing. We had teacher coaches. So I could identify a problem in a class and say, okay, look, maybe we need to do A or B with the class. So the coaches would come in and coach the teacher on how to do it. So they would lead the class first. Then they would sit and get feedback from the teacher. What do they think of it? They would then plan a lesson together and co-teach it. And then the third step is the teacher would do it on their own. And the coach would feedback with them every 2 or 3 weeks to see how they were doing. I would come in and say, okay, yeah, look, we're getting places here. This is going to be our next project. So there was huge support in the system. And that was brilliant.
These were expert teachers who were doing the coaching.
These were expert teachers. Yeah, they were employed as coaches. You know, they were all rounders. They were really high standard, high quality teachers who were like known for their excellence in teaching. And their job during the day, so they would have maybe 2 hours of research where they would research methodologies and say, this is good, this is what we need to try. Or, you know, I'd be doing my research as well and say, maybe, look, can we try this? So there'd be huge discourse, and then they're there on staff, as part of the staff, as part of the team. And it really brought up standards, you know.
Sounds like a great resource to have.
It was fantastic. Staff, yeah. It was fantastic. You know, it's something I'd like to see develop in Ireland, which it can be done, you know, cluster schools and have a coach with them, a teaching coach with them to come in and to work on improving standards or improving certain areas of curriculum. So then I came back to Europe.
Okay, I'll come back to that in a minute. Can I come back to the European schools? Because you said that your teaching changed a lot over the 6 years that you were teaching there.
Yeah.
How would you characterize that change in your teaching?
I'd put it like this. So I suppose in Ireland, we look at one way of doing things, right? In that we're an island nation. It's very rare that we'd actually look outside what other countries are doing. For example, I never once in my 6 years here thought to look at how the UK were teaching reading or what resources were available in the UK. Like, the 53 million people, they have so much resources going into literacy on a yearly basis. We don't have that capacity. I never once thought of, let's see, what have they got over there? You know, how are they doing things? So that was just the eye-opener. And then seeing other countries say, yeah, I like that. Like, say, I got a few sofas into my room, which really changed the atmosphere in how I thought it was in Bar at the Top, which was at the time is what you did, you know? And like, or even was going to group work. No, forget the group work. Let's sit on the sofa and let's have a chat about things and, you know, see what the kids want. I suppose the other thing would have been the parent-teacher meetings. We would have at parent-teacher-children, so a triangular, tripartite meeting, as opposed to just a bilateral meeting where the kids would be involved and the kids would actually be leading the meeting, you know, saying what they felt. And then the teacher would interject with, okay, look, yeah, but, you know. So their voice was heard. And, you know, you have a parent-teacher meeting with a parent, it's great, you're talking about the child, but you want to affect the change in the child. But if they're not there and they're not part of the conversation, how can you affect change? So all of these little things helped in, I suppose, changing my, I suppose, perspective on how I did things.
How different or how similar to the Irish curriculum is the curriculum in the European schools? I mean, are the subjects taught the same?
I suppose we would be considered quite forward-thinking in our curriculum. And the Irish Inspectorate, I am the only teacher in Ireland who was inspected every single year of my 14 years overseas by an Irish inspector. And I would guarantee you, I'm the only principal in Ireland with an 8-page report on my role as principal. When I was principal of the European schools, in my year two, I had a review, a 3-day review with 4 inspectors, led by the Irish inspector and 3 more other European inspectors, with an 8-page report on me at the end of it. You know, so it's very much Irish influence. Irish education is considered really, really good, really strong. The curriculum is considered good. And the Irish voice is quite strong in European schools. So when they were developing curriculum, we were always on the curriculum review boards. And because of that, a lot of what's in the European school curriculum really reflects what we're doing here. You know, and so literacy was completely what we're doing here. Math would have been with our own inter-math scheme is what it's called, but it's based very, very closely and very closely aligned to our own. So it was like literally teaching what you were teaching at home. When I came back, the curriculum was so easy to identify the curriculum because it was literally the same thing.
And do they use textbooks in the schools?
No, we didn't have any textbooks. That was the biggest change when I came back 5 years ago, saying, oh my God, look at the number of books we had. We created our own lessons. I found that quite a challenge at the beginning because I didn't have the confidence. I said, but it's all in the book, you know? And then you're saying, okay, you look at your class and say, what's my objective? What do I actually want to achieve with the kids? And then developing your own curriculum, developing your own sort of lesson content was invigorating. And it was something, yes, it took time, but that's where, there was great team spirit, great teamwork and collaboration. And we would collaborate and do an awful lot of that together, you know? And over time, then you do build up a huge bank of resources that is specific to your school and your own needs. And I think textbooks have a place to an extent. It's nice to have a resource bank of them to see what's there. But like, curriculum comes from, let's say, in our case here, the NCCA. The publishers are producing curriculum, are producing the textbooks. Are they completely aligned? Not at all, you know? And I think it's the one thing I did notice when I came home, and it's not a criticism, but it's just, we do have a huge dependency on textbooks compared to what I would have been used to, or we didn't have any, you know?
And that must have taken a huge amount of time then to prepare if you had nothing to begin with, for, you know, no textbooks for that.
Yeah, like ours, we'd be in school at 7. We'd start at 8. Kids would be gone at 3. We would still be there at 5:30 every day. But there was such camaraderie and such fun. It was a fun thing. And like, we looked after staff as well, you know, pizzas arriving in, there'd be fruit bowls arriving in, it might be a Thursday afternoon, we're finishing at 5 o'clock, come on, we're all going up to the wine bar. And there was just huge camaraderie. And, you know, I suppose you're making a conscious decision to leave Ireland for your job. It's not like you're here, you have your life and you have a job. You're leaving because of your job. You're making a real conscious decision to go somewhere because of your job. And you build a life around that then, as opposed to having a life and having a job. So it's completely turning everything upside down, you know. And I suppose because of that, you're willing to put the hours in and you're willing to work, and it's you're asking for this experience yourself, you know.
And was there a lot of turnover among the students if they're, you know, if they're there because their parents are working for a period of time in the European Union?
Normally the contracts would be between 5 and 7 years. So you would get like the whole of their primary education. But yes, there was a quite a big turnover of kids. There definitely was, you know. But I think I'm seeing it here as well now. There's a way more movement than what there was before I left, you know, where you would have the same class from, you know, they come in junior infants with 28 kids, they leave in sixth class, the same 28 kids. That's definitely changed, and we would have seen a huge turnover of that in the European schools, you know.
So you came back to Ireland then after
After Qatar. To Germany, and was head of the European school in Germany there, primary head of the European school in Germany there. And that was very interesting in that I was head of my own school, and quite a complex school, and quite, again, all of the sort of, you know, I had 7 international sections. I had, 8 mother tongue sections where, you know, you have kids from all over Europe getting mother tongue tuition as well. Some of it was by video conference. Some of it was, you know, live, where you're getting teachers in for 2 or 3 hours a week. And
were you head of primary, or were you
head of primary?
Because they have primary in early years and post primary, isn't
exactly
that right?
So you have primary in early years and post primary on the same campus. So you have a primary head, you have a secondary head, and you have an overall head. Irish primary teachers can never become overall head unless they are secondary trained, because you have to be able to lead a student to a university entrance, you know. So in other words, you have to be able to teach Leaving Cert or lead to Leaving Cert. Primary, we can't do that. So, you know, I suppose our choice was primary head. But it was interesting because I had maternelle, which was the kindergarten. So I would have from the 3-year-olds to the 12-year-olds. And we worked closely with the post-primary as well, so you could see their transitions over and how they were getting on. It was very interesting, you know, and you could do things. You know, you would put your plan for the year. I suppose the biggest difference structure-wise was, you know, I had a bursar. I'm no good in finance. So, like, I had to put my pedagogical plans for the year. I'd have to make my pedagogical plans and then budget them and cost them. You know, they would never say no, but if it was in the budget, I could do it. If I hadn't budgeted it, we would have to wait till the following year. So I got the circus in 1 week. We actually, on campus, built a full big top circus. And the tent, the works, and the circus personnel came in and worked with the kids for the whole week and gave them a circus skill. You know, I had one guy with autism up 2 meters high on a bike. I was there, oh, Jesus, he's going to fall. But the joy, kids fire eating and everything like that. So, and they put on 2 shows on the Saturday for the parents, you know.
Where did that idea come from?
I just saw a circus and said, oh, that might be a good idea. So then we're looking, and in Germany, you can do these things. You don't have the same health and safety rules, you know. So you couldn't do it here, you know, with the litigious culture that we have. But there, I was guess of, yeah, give the kids these experiences. So we had circus school for a week. So we planned, we spent a few weeks planning all our pedagogical happenings in school around what you would do in a circus, you know. So they were learning in science, you know, what were the mixtures that they were taking for the fire eating, and why did it cause fire, and, you know, and the maths, okay, we're going up 2 meters, like the velocity of a fall, just in case you fell, and all this sort of thing. So we built everything around it for 2 weeks, for the week leading up to it, and then we did a week of just hands-on practical learning skill set, and then 2 shows with the teachers and kids involved, and we all got involved. It was brilliant, you know. But experiences like that, I suppose, that, you know, that are quite unique, that you wouldn't get here. They were fantastic.
So how did those experiences then inform your work as principal when you returned to Ireland as principal?
I suppose when I came back then, it was a case of, right, planning. Forward planning and prioritising what you're going to do. I think there's so much going on in Irish schools. It's you know, it's quite intense. And I think, like, one of the big things we're doing here at conference at the moment is the PIEW model, you know, of trying to slow things down. And I suppose that's what I brought back with me. It's a case of, well, look, I had to budget for A, B and C in the year, and that's what we did, and, like, we built all our CPD and everything around it. So let's do the same thing here, you know. So it's a case of, yeah, we've all of this going on, but what are we going to focus in on? What are the things that we're really going to look at and really sort of pilot, see, make the tweaks, see where the issues are, and then once we're happy with after piloting it, make decision, are we going to move forward, or are we going to really implement it in the school and then embed it in our DNA of the school? So I suppose that was one of the big learnings I brought back with me. It's a case of slow things down, do something, something small. I think we always look at the apple and take this massive bite out of it. Like, take the small bite, take a little bit, do it well. And like, you've incremental gains. Every year you're building on that, and you have that whole thing of gaining incrementally every year. I suppose that was my big learning coming home.
The difficulty with that is that once you choose certain things, you're omitting other things. And I think that's what principals find so difficult. They want to do so much more. And sometimes they kind of think that, well, if I prioritize this, then I have to say goodbye to this idea.
Yeah, true. But that's where the discussion comes in with your staff. You know, like, get the kids' voice in, get the staff voice. What do they want? What do we... And you bring it back to your values. I think we underestimate hugely in our schools our value system. Like, what are we about? Why are we here? Why are we here? What is our raison d'etre for being here, right? In our school, and not the school down the road. Doesn't matter what they're doing, but us right here. What are we about? What do we value? Does it link in with our values? Does it link in with departmental, you know, frameworks and everything like that? If what we're going to do doesn't match with that, well, then we have to ask the question, should we actually be doing it? You know, and we do an awful lot of things that without thinking, we just go and we do it. Yeah, come on, let's do it. That's a great idea. Come on. And there's great momentum behind it. And then after a year, it's a case of, okay, that's day to day, you know? So let's stop and think beforehand. Like, do we really want this? Is this what we want people to identify with our school? And I think, yes, you could be taking on 100 initiatives a week at this stage, but it's a case of, let's do one thing and do it well and make it about our values and what we're about. Make it reflect what we're doing in our school. So I think if you have that mentality behind it and you're sharing that with the whole school community and say, look, yeah, brilliant idea, but let's pause that for a while and let's focus on this and do this well. And it takes a lot of the stress out of people's lives of, oh, we need to do this, oh, we need to do that. No, this is what we're focusing on. Let's do this. Let's do it well. Let's get it through. So, yeah, I think, yeah, there is the point that there's a huge amount of initiatives, but how about just taking one that suits us and our values?
What were the biggest challenges you found in being principal in Ireland?
When I came back first, it was my own pace was quite, yeah, I was going to really, really high level, but like it was go, 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 go. Because I suppose I was working with teams who, again, as I said earlier, we're there for work, you know? So you were there for your work, and that was why you were in that country, and everything else fit in around that. Here, teachers have a good life-work balance, you know? So people were going home and said, but where are you going? Where are our discussions, you know? I was missing my after-school meetings every day where you're talking with people and you're having the discourse, and like, it's 5 o'clock, you say, okay, it's time to go home now. So that for me was my biggest challenge at the beginning. I suppose it's dealing with people. People are complex, you know, and it's about trying to have what's best for your team, looking after each team member, same with your parent community, same with your kids, and trying to sort of keep time for yourself as well and all that, because when you lose sight of self, you know, you're no good to anybody. And it's very, very easy to lose sight of self with so much going on. But I suppose it's managing people and just making sure that people are okay, that they're looked after, that they feel valued. And that takes time. You know, like whether it's your caretaker, whether it's your bus escort, whether it's your teacher, whether it's your SNA, everyone needs to feel valued. And as principal, I feel that's my role to make sure that, yes, they feel valued and a real genuine value, not just, you know, oh yeah, thank you for that, or, you know, it's sort of lip service, but it's coming from the heart that there's, you know, authenticity behind it.
And then after your time as principal, you got involved in professional development for principals. Yes. How did that happen?
So when I was in the European schools, I would have been traveling to a lot of the schools doing in-service in music, in literacy, in assessment. So I knew that I had the capability to do it. So when I came back, to me, it's important. I felt, yeah, look, I've been one of the few principals who has possibly been overseas and have had different experiences. I'm more than willing to share anything that I have. So from the get-go, I just said, yeah, I want to be involved. I want to help out. I want to share as much as I can. And that's where it all stemmed from. And I suppose as time has gone on, it's a confidence thing too. You get more confident at developing your own material and you know, and you review it. You know, you do a seminar and you get the feedback and say, okay, that didn't work. Okay, let's tweak that for the next time. And I really, really loved that aspect of it as well. I suppose it wasn't school, it's still education, which I'm passionate about and I love. But it was a different sort of, a different aspect of it, you know. And that's how it all began.
And what are the biggest needs that you've seen from Irish primary principals?
I think they don't give themselves enough credit for what they're doing in schools, you know, to actually give themselves a pat on the back and say, do you know what, you're doing a great job, you know. I think there is this feeling that, oh, we need to be doing more, you're not doing enough. It's a case of, no, do you know what, you are actually doing a fantastic job. Look at your school, look at how your kids are thriving. You know, look at how your team is working with you. Yeah, and you'll have your good days, you'll have your bad days. But that the sustainability of the job is what I worry about. You know, I'm looking and seeing that a lot of principals are being appointed now at 30, 32, 33 years old. They're going to be there till they're 68, 69. That's 30, 35 years as a principal. We have to start looking at a way to make it sustainable, to actually, that it's not just the principal, that there's the whole team, that every member of staff has a role to play in leadership. Teacher leaders, middle leaders, aspiring leaders, that they're all part of the big picture, and we need to encourage that more. And I think that's possibly one of the challenges. I know for me, at the beginning, I'm the only one who can do this. I'm the only one who can do it the way I want it in my head. You know, I want it like this. I want this looking like that, and I need this in the policy. This is what I want. And it's because, you know, it's not about you, you know. Others might do it differently, but it will just be as good, if not even better, and it will see things that you will never see. So I think it's that realization among yourself that you're not infallible, that it's not all about you, that it's about the whole community and giving people that chance to do things. And I think failing as well, you know, that failed myself and Dan, who is the principal of the school now since I'm on secondment. We were always talking about, we'd love to get the word fail into our mission statement, that first attempt in learning, you know, that it's okay for us to fail. It's okay for the kids to see us failing, because if they are looking and striving for perfection the whole time, they're never going to take risks and they're never going to take chances. And we're the same for a developing team. Yeah, mess up. It's okay. You know, it's okay to mess up. But let's sit down and see, where do we mess up? How would we do things differently the next time? And take that learning away from it. If we can get that mindset into principles, because I know I'm a perfectionist. Oh, it has to be this, it has to be that. But if we can change that around, I think it could be liberating, actually, for everybody.
So can you tell me about one of your failures?
Oh, jeez, where do I start? One of my failures, oh, my God. When I was in Germany, I decided, yeah, we need to have an expected sort of, we call them ESLRs, expected school-wide learning results for the children, right? That were not academic, that were all about their social interactions, becoming global citizens, effective communicators, all of this. So I would go home, like, this is what we're doing. Got a graphic designer, got the whole thing done, posters made up, the whole school in every language, and then go around. And then I approached staff about it. Said, lads, this is what we're going to do. Biggest rookie mistake ever, you know? Instead of starting from the ground up, this came from the top down. Top down initiatives don't work. Yes, it worked for the few years I was there because I was pushing it. When I left, you could see after 2 years, it had gone. Whereas when I came back here, I decided, let's start at the other end. What do teachers want? And, you know, get the priorities from them. So when I went to Douglas first, my first staff meeting, I had a survey monkey for them. Okay, what's really working well in our school? Let's celebrate that. And where's our area for growth? And that's where we started. And brought that back to staff and say, okay, look, lads, these are our areas for growth. Can we pick one? And what would you like to do with it? And we have momentum and we have, you know, we are embedding things from there now to this day. So that was, yeah, one of my biggest failures was like, yeah, come on, top down, I'm telling you what to do, let's go do it, you know.
We're coming near the end, Finbar, and I have a few general questions now that I put to every guest on the program. And the first one is, what is school for, or what are schools for, in your view?
Schools to me is a safe space where kids can learn about life. Simple, you know, that's it, you know.
Was there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
There was a lot, there was more than one, I suppose. If I had to cut it down to one, it would be difficult. I suppose my primary school teachers gave me a sense of value, you know, what to value in life. My secondary school teachers, I suppose, appreciated me for me. You know, I'd be quite flamboyant, and they encouraged that in me. And, you know, it was lovely to have that encouragement from an early age. This case of, you know, just be who you are. And I suppose my big message always to this day to kids, just be yourself. You know, be yourself. If people will like you, if they like you, if they don't, that's, you know, it's not your problem. But just be yours. Be true to yourself. You know, and I think that's what I got from my secondary school. Two or three teachers in secondary school especially, which was great.
What's your vision of an educated person?
My vision of an educated person? Someone who has a good value system, who knows what they're about themselves, you know, and has confidence to express that.
Is there a book or blog or writer about education that you particularly like?
I love Simon Sinek. You know, in general, just his whole, you know, a lot of his writings are really interesting. It might necessarily be school-based, all of them, but there's huge learning from that. I think sometimes, especially with leadership, I think there's huge learning from looking outside of our profession to see how other people lead, and we can take great learning of that. So as a leader, I like looking at sort of leadership writings and things like that. I like Fulham as well, but yeah, and Andy Hargreaves is very interesting. I've just started one, Wholesome Leadership, by a principal in the UK, just in the first chapter of it. So I'm looking forward to getting into that. He's talking about, you know, that leadership comes from the heart and the whole authenticity of leadership. And I think sometimes we're afraid to be ourselves as school leaders, and I'm really interested to see where that's going to bring me.
You know? And Simon Sinek, is there anything in particular by him that you like?
I love his one line, be the last to speak, you know? So as a leader, you come into a room, staff meeting, and you have a new idea. And if you speak first, say, oh, you know, we'll do this, and I think this, what do you think? So straight away, if it's set, you know, you've your expectation out there, and it's a case of, oh, this is what we need to do. Whereas if you get everyone else's opinion first and get the real feeling of where they are with it and take that on board and then give your opinion at the end, well, then you're changing that dynamic completely.
Who or what inspires you?
I suppose I'm passionate about creativity and just, like, if I had a who, it would be this guy called Luke Jefferson Day. He's editor of GQ magazine in London. He's the most authentic person I've ever come across in himself, just in self-expression, in being himself, in not apologizing for who he is or anything like that. I like that, you know? And I suppose there's one more, Simone Marchetti, who's an Italian. Again, he's in the sort of whole world, the whole creative world. He's a very interesting guy as well. So I like that outside of education. It's good to have sort of other sort of passions.
And is there a what as well as a who?
What? I suppose education inspires me, really. You know, that would be the what. I just love what I do. I feel very privileged to be in education, to do what I do on a daily basis. I love it. So, yeah, that's my what.
And in your school, if there was one thing you could change and resources were not an issue, what would it be?
I suppose space, you know. I think space is completely undervalued, as in classroom space, you know. I would have massive classrooms with sofas in Ireland. I'd have massive classrooms with sofas and just really homely environment and smaller class sizes.
And what's the benefit of sofas?
It's much more relaxed. You know, I can sit down here and have a chat with a kid. Kid's having an issue. All right, come on, let's talk about it. Or we're working on something. We're working on a project together. It's not the teacher, the group around the table, you know. I think sofas are conducive to conversation, you know. And I think we as educators, what we're doing is we're having conversations with our kids the whole time, you know. And it's developing that whole art of conversation. And so it's in a social media world or, you know, world where there is such technology, the art of conversation is dying. And I think if we can develop that more in our young kids, I think it would be great.
And finally, Finbar, what from your own primary or post-primary experience most influences your practice in education today?
I suppose my relationships with kids. I suppose what I saw was my primary school was a very small community, and the teachers were had really strong relationships with the kids, the parents, with the school community. And I suppose that to me is paramount. You know, the day that I don't enjoy being around 5-year-olds is the day that I need to stop what I'm doing. You know, I get such a kick of going into a classroom and going in and going down on my knees and seeing what they're up to and having a laugh with them and having good fun with them. And yes, you know, it's a case of it's not all fun, but it's you have to have that banter. You have to have that relationship with kids. And I suppose one thing I was most proud of school was I knew every single kid in that school, and I knew them well. And we'd have the banter, we'd have fun, but they knew, and when things got serious and there was an issue, there was huge respect there. And I think it was that whole respect area, and it's just the relationships that would be the important thing for me.
And that was Finbar Hurley affirming the importance of relationships across the school community when I spoke to him at the edge of the Irish Primary Principals Network conference last month. Finbar is a coordinator of the Centre for School Leadership and a board member of the Irish Primary Principals Network. That's all we have on this week's podcast. If you enjoyed it, I'd be grateful if you could post a review wherever you get your podcasts. That will help more people hear about it. You can listen to or download almost 400 previous episodes of Inside Education by going to my website, seandelaney.com, and clicking on podcasts. You can write to me by email to insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com or follow me on Twitter @InsideEd. My book about teaching, which has chapters on topics such as behaviour management and work-life balance, is Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have. You can borrow it from your local library or buy it from an online bookstore. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.